Welcome to the Project Love podcast. I'm Selena Barker.
And I'm Vicky Pavitt. In these podcasts, we explore what it takes to create a life, relationship, and career you love.
And not just one that looks good on the outside, but one that feels good on the inside.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Project Love podcast. It's Vicky here, the love and dating coach of the Project Love duo, and I have such a treat of an episode for you today. I got to interview the wonderful Dr. Sophie Mort, aka Dr. Soph. Dr. Soph is a clinical psychologist with a personal mission to get psychology out of the therapy room and into people's lives in a way that works for them. In the episode, we talk all about Sophie's brilliant new book, A Manual for Being Human, a book that I absolutely loved. It's so practical. It's packed full of super useful tools and techniques that you can start using right away. And it's also full of so much love and compassion as well. Dr. Soph is like a really kind, wise and loving friend who can reassure you, empower you and teach you practical tools to help you to move forward. But who's also a doctor. She has an undergraduate degree in psychology, a master's in neuroscience, and a doctorate in clinical psychology, and has worked on the front line at London's Homerton Hospital. Realising the system wasn't working for so many people, she left behind her traditional role as a clinical psychologist in the NHS and has helped thousands manage their emotional well-being by sharing her psychological knowledge on Instagram, her blog, and through her online private practice. She's also an expert for the mindfulness app Happy Not Perfect and has been featured in global outlets including Vice Magazine, Girl Boss, Psych Central, Well and Good, and Elite Daily. In the episode, we talk about the childhood experiences that shape us, why we struggle and why we have down days. We talk about emotions, their purpose, and how to manage them so they don't overwhelm us. We talk about emotional intelligence, what it is and how it can improve our health and relationships. We talk about the power of understanding your attachment style, including Soph's personal experience of having an avoidant attachment style. And I share some of my experience of having an anxious attachment style. And we also talk about self-care and self-care toolkits for times of stress, grounding exercises for overwhelm, and so much more. Talking to Soph was such a treat. It really brightened up what is a very grey, rainy day in London today. I love this conversation and I can't wait for you to listen to it. A Manual for Being Human is out on the 8th of July and I'll include the link to pre-order in the show notes. So, without further ado, here is the episode with Dr. Soph. I hope you enjoy it. Dr. Soph, a huge welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm very well, and thank you so much for inviting me on. It's a real treat.
So good to have you on. I've got your book in my hands, A Manual for Being Human. It's very dogged. It's got lots of post-its and folded down pages. I absolutely loved reading it. First of all, thank you for writing such a brilliant and helpful book for people, especially during these times of uncertainty. It struck me reading A Manual for Being Human, how much we actually need a manual for being human. And I was reading it, wishing that someone had given me this book when I was at school, because it's so, so helpful, so useful. Why do you think, well, I've got two questions actually. First of all, what motivated you to write the book? And why do you think we need this manual for being human?
Well, I'm very excited for you to ask these questions. And I kind of have two answers to your two questions. And one is, when I was little, my grandma had this manual or this book. I honestly couldn't tell you what it's called, but it had the answer to absolutely everything in it. You know, so I was often getting really grubby and I'd get, you know, grass stains in my knees or I'd have a hole in my socks. She'd be like, "Don't worry, darling." And she'd go and grab the manual, whatever it was. And she'd be like, "Okay, so we get grass stains out this way and we darn socks this way." Or things like if the gravy was too greasy, she'd go to the manual and it would have the answer. It basically made me think when I was little, it doesn't really matter what happens. Gran has the answer in this magic book she has. And growing up, there were pretty much manuals for everything else as well. You know, For example, family members had cards with these manuals on how to fix them themselves. When I started getting into arts and crafts, there were manuals on knitting. There was manuals on literally everything. So one of the things around this manual is I really, really wanted people to have a place where they could gain probably the most important information we can have in this world, you know, that makes sense of why we feel the way we do, the common reasons we get stuck, and how to overcome pretty much anything. Because as you know, if you've read this book, it covers almost every aspect of being human. And you can read it as one story, as in from front to back, layering up your understanding of humanity and psychology, or you can return to it and dip in and out depending on what's going on in your life. So that's kind of answer one, linked to your idea of you're so right. It's so fundamental, the information that we aren't given in school. We learn about sin, cos, and tan, something I've never used school, right? But I was never taught about emotions, never taught about anxiety. And that leads me on to the second reason for writing this book. And that is I, at the age of 18, started having panic attacks. And I had no information on what they were. Really could only reference movies where I'd seen people have, be labeled as having mental illness and then being labeled as mad or bad, such as One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which I know is way before our time, but still is a film I would reference at that time. So I thought I was losing my mind, eventually got therapy. And when I learned how to overcome the panic, I was like, right, I need to learn everything I can about psychology. And once I have learned that, I'm going to find a way to share it so that no one feels as lost or terrified as I did at that age. So I studied, you know, undergraduate, master's, doctorate in psychology, became a clinical psychologist, worked in the NHS, and just saw time and time again that no matter what service I was in, it could have been brain injury, it could have been an autism service, it could have been mental health, that people were coming through the door in a similar way. So how I was at 18, lacking the fundamental kind of basic understanding of psychology. It wasn't their fault. It wasn't the NHS's fault. It's the fact that we're just not taught it. So I decided, right, time to tie all these ideas together, the need for a manual, the need to share, and essentially wrote more than everything that people could do with learning into one place. And you have that in your hands right now.
Yes, it's here. It's amazing. So I'm a big psychology geek. We were just saying before we hit record how I am so passionate about this topic. I studied at university. My mom was always really into psychology, and there was always books on the bookshelf, you know, growing up about the mind and behavior, and, you know, I grew up with those books. But every book I read, every psychology text that was recommended through my, 5 years of studying it, really, including A-level, they were always really theory-based and difficult.
So dry. Oh, my word, so dry. And the covers, okay, the covers of these books makes you want to hide them. Just like, I don't want to read that. I already know the inside is going to be boring. Even if it's educational, I don't want to know. I don't know if you feel like that, but that was always my experience with psychology textbooks.
Yeah, yeah. And they were always really big and thick and just quite intimidating, let's be honest.
Very much so.
And I love that you've poured into this book the most powerful, useful things that we need to know. So all from those, you've read the books for us, thank you.
Yes.
To put it into this really accessible, easy to read guide. But it's just the love, I can feel the love that you've poured into this book. With every chapter, there's a love note from you checking in, how you're doing, what you've been learning, how you're feeling. Let's take a minute to ground ourselves. And I just loved it. I felt like every chapter you were just there, you know, giving your love and compassion to the reader. I felt like we were friends.
Oh, that's so nice. That's definitely my best hope. You know, it wasn't just that I wanted to create something that was accessible for people to read before they actually needed it, i.e. before they were struggling, or also when they're struggling. It was the fact that I think we have all got the experience, or all had the experience that you had, which is often when psychology is talked about, we're getting it from these dry, dusty textbooks, or we were imagining it was going to come from someone who wasn't very personable, who perhaps could judge us, or who perhaps didn't have the same life experiences as us. And so when I wrote that book, I wanted it to feel a bit like you were talking to your really, really knowledgeable friend who loved you so very much, but also knew what they were talking about.
Yes.
Right? Who wasn't just saying, oh, mate, you're going to be all right because I love you, but was like, no, I really know that you're going to be all right because of X and Y, and you can put these things into practice now. So I'm really glad that you... That tone really resonated with you, because that's what I was really going for. Because, yeah, you know, one of the things that we struggle the most with, I think, isn't just the fact that it's normal to have bad days or absolutely terrible days. It's the fact that on top of that, most of us beat ourselves up. Very few of us have access to that deeply compassionate voice in our life. And so I really wanted to create a book. I know that. So what's interesting is we internalize everything that we come across all day. So, for example, if you read that book, you literally internalize the voice of that book. It means that as you go forwards, when you're being critical to yourself, you have this little, hopefully, angel voice on your shoulder that's weirdly mine going, no, no, you're great. Don't worry. You've got this. The reason you feel this is because of that. The reason you're saying this is because of this. And you can move forwards. You're going to get there through these skills.
Yeah, I really believe that compassion and self-acceptance is the foundation of change. Ooh. And I felt that you really met people where they are in the book. So I think anyone can pick up the book and feel really seen, even though it's about so many things. I think that's such a skill to be able to do that. And I think when people are able to normalize and accept, you know, where they are and what they're feeling, it's just so... comforting, but so liberating as well, because it means, you know, there's nothing wrong with us. And I know that when I get stuck in self-criticism, when I go into a bit of a spiral, I can start to tell myself that story of, oh, there's something wrong with you, or a story of inadequacy or failure. And I love that you spoke to that in the book. And it really, I felt like the key message in the book is like, whatever you're feeling is totally okay and totally normal and natural. There's nothing wrong with you.
Yeah, even in your darkest times, you know, for example, I think what people might be surprised about in this book is that it's not just talking about, oh, if you don't love yourself, or oh, if you don't accept yourself. It's talking about if you're having deep panic attacks. It's talking about if you're experiencing intrusive thoughts every day. It's talking about if you open your social media and feel absolutely terrible about yourself. It's talking about structural inequality and about how prejudice affects us all. And the reason I wanted to state that is because I think often when we think about books that are going to be compassionate and tell you that you can accept yourself, we assume it's going to be quite surface level. I don't know if you feel like that, but, you know, like, oh, you were worthy at birth. Yes, you were. I agree with that. But let's go a level deeper and really tackle what it is that's made you feel like you aren't worthy now. And maybe that's one of a million things. And even in your darkest hours, when you can point out things that you really do believe are truly wrong with you, you're still normal. You're still human. And it still makes sense.
Yeah. And that not everything is... up to the individual to change. Yeah. There was something that you wrote about. It's kind of made me think about, you know, an individual level versus a societal level, that there's it all interplays.
Yeah.
I'm probably not articulating that very well, but it was something that you said about psychology being both personal and political.
Yes, 100%. 100%. And, you know, a lot of people, when they are struggling, assume that the answers will be found within inside themselves. So let's say, for example, you're having panic attacks. It's absolutely true that one of the main steps is going to be sharing that you feel this way with someone and learning, for example, breathing exercises, grounding techniques, and other skills that help you overcome panic. But let's say, for example, your anxiety or panic attacks is arising in the context of prejudice. Maybe you've experienced lots of homophobia. Maybe you've experienced lots of racism, then actually it's not just that you need to do the work internally. It's the fact that we need to stop those things from happening in the first place. So maybe you want to connect with a community who have your shared experience. That will also bolster you. But maybe you want to start campaigning for change, using the like quite understandable rage that a lot of us feel when we see prejudice, to actually campaign for the kind of change that means people in future generations don't live through the same thing as we're living through. So yes, psychology is very much personal and very much political.
I love that you spoke to that, because I think that in the self-help world, let's say, there's things like the law of attraction that can give you this message that if you just focus on your thoughts that you'll be able to manifest your dream reality. Yeah. And it's just not the case.
And it's also very dangerous, that message, for people who've had a very bad time. Yeah. You know, I think that there's absolutely space for the law of attraction and for manifestation. And at the same time, I see people who come in who've had awful things happen to them, who say, does this mean that I manifested this? Was it because I was thinking negative thoughts or sending out negative energy that I was abused in this way? And I'm like, absolutely not. There's nothing that you did that caused this to happen. So I just wanted to put that as a little interlude, that those kind of messages can also be quite damaging in the end for people who, yeah, experience very difficult things in the world.
One of the things that I was thinking was that our brains, our ancient brains, are not quite, they were never designed for this modern world that we live in today. And it's like we're in this kind of transition point where, well, I guess it's why the coping mechanisms are so helpful, because we need these coping mechanisms to help us to feel safe in this quite anxiety provoking world that we live in.
Yeah. We have ancient brains that aren't adapted to this world yet. Absolutely. And so we need to find ways of adjusting.
As a psychologist, what are the main struggles that you help people with?
Oh, gosh. So not in my private work, I help people with pretty much everything, because my issue is that I'm a generalist. You know, so a lot of people are taught, I don't know about you, but when you set out in business on your own, you're taught that you should find your niche, right? So talk specifically about love and dating, for example. Mm-hmm. Whereas I like to talk about absolutely everything that makes us human. I have more of a breadth of knowledge, I'd say, than perhaps like one specific topic that I know every single thing about. I would not claim to have that at all. But in my private work, what I tend to do is work with people who feel like on paper or to the world, they seem like they're doing well. They seem perhaps even like they're killing it on paper. You know, other people look at them and say, wow, you're doing such a great job. And on the inside, they feel like the opposite. So, for example, maybe on the inside, they're struggling with low self-esteem. Maybe they're struggling with attachment issues and find dating and relationships incredibly difficult and overwhelming. Maybe they have intrusive thoughts, such as it's very common for people to have thoughts of harming other people that just flash up, and it's totally normal, but because they feel responsible for it, don't realize that those thoughts will come and go as long as you let them to, but take responsibility. They then think that there's something wrong with them. So I work with people who feel like there's a big mismatch between how they feel inside and how they feel outside, and they'd like to find a way to feel good about themselves.
And what would you say kind of drives a lot of these struggles?
The struggles that come up in the book that you have in your hands, they are around, okay, let's separate out part one of the book, for example, which also leads into what I do with my private clients. It's the fact that you come into the world inherently worthy, right? You come into the world and your brain is approximately 30% developed. Well, approximately third developed, sorry. By the time you're 25, your brain will be fully wired and connected. But that kind of early 25 years of life, your brain is undergoing continuous shifts, and what shapes who we are and what ultimately leads us to troubles, which are almost always, I don't know what you think about this, but people almost always come with problems such as, I am constantly critical towards myself. I have negative self-beliefs and stories I tell about myself. I struggle in my relationships and I'm overwhelmed by my emotions. Now, actually, there are many reasons why you might struggle with any of these things. So, for example, the first few years of life, you know, when you grow up around people who are loving to you or not so loving to you, you develop what we call attachment styles, which I think you've talked about before on this podcast. Is that right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes.
So blueprints, right, of the way we relate to people. That's where your story of whether you're a good or a bad person starts. Then, for example, you might even have a wonderful first few years, but maybe in school, when you're developing your identity, you come up against bullying, or you're given misinformation around identity and what you're allowed to be in terms of gender and your sexuality. Then the third chapter of the book talks about marketing and media, because I don't know about you, but even if you have this beautiful childhood and beautiful teenage years, you can still end up struggling with your emotions, your relationships, and your kind of self-belief. If you're bombarded by perfect images in magazines, I say perfect in inverted commas because they're normally heavily airbrushed, highly curated. Yeah, if you're bombarded by images that tell you who is worthy in the world is someone who's perfect, then you're going to end up constantly looking in the mirror and thinking, oh my word, I don't match up to what I see each day. This often leads to feelings of low self-worth. Prejudice can also affect this, and so can life events such as breakups, deaths of loved ones, loneliness. So you ask, for example, what can be the main causes of this? It could literally be anything that happens in your life that signals to you that you are meant to be someone other than who you are. And then in terms of what keeps it going, often misinformation, right? So like, if you don't understand what your emotions are, if you think you're meant to be happy all the time, which most of us, I think, are taught right now, you could have a bad day. You could have an anxious day. You could have an angry day. When those strong emotions come up, you might panic because you assume this isn't how you're meant to be feeling. And suddenly a fleeting emotion spirals into a bigger emotion. And if you don't know how to cope with that, then you end up getting stuck.
And then we can judge ourselves for having the emotion and keep it locked in place. I know you talk a lot about managing emotions in the book. How would you describe what an emotion is, and why is it important that we learn to manage them?
Well, firstly, it's to manage them, ironically, we need to understand them. So it's a great question that you've just asked. Okay, how do we summarize what they are? So most people assume that emotions are things that happen or feelings that we get in response to what happens in our lives. Few people realize that emotions are physical sensations that arise in our body actually in advance of things happening in our life. So for example, if you were walking down the street and you saw, I don't know, your favorite meal or smelt your favorite meal wafting out of a doorway, or if you saw someone and you were like, ooh, hello, sexy, your brain would anticipate that you are coming across something that would help you survive. I mean, to help you thrive, sorry. Suddenly, your internal state would change, right? So oxytocin, dopamine, feel-good hormones and chemicals would flood through your body. And you would have this urge to turn towards those delicious things in front of you. And we would call those the emotions of happiness, interest and arousal. Okay. However, if you're walking down the street and you saw an enemy of yours, or if you got a text message from your boss, for example, or your lover saying we need to talk, and your brain predicted that that meant the relationship or the job was over, your body would flood instead with adrenaline and cortisol, so stress hormones. You would have the urge to either run for your life, or you'd be frozen to the spot, or you might actually have the urge to turn towards the situation and fight. And these would be the emotions that we call fear, anxiety, and the one where we turn towards and fight, anger. So all emotions have a purpose. They are the physical sensations that arise in our body when our brain predicts something is happening or is about to happen that will either help us survive or help us thrive. And your other question was, how do we cope with them? I suppose, firstly, does that make sense in terms of understanding them?
Yeah, it makes total sense. Would you say, because I'm familiar with the wheel of emotions, feelings wheel, would you say that all emotions come from core emotions, so that the ones that you just mentioned, that all other types of emotions like feeling surprised or disappointment, do they come from those core emotions that you just described?
Well, what's really interesting is surprise is the emotion that you have when you predict something wrongly. Okay, so say for example, have you got a window in front of you?
No.
A door?
A door, yes.
Okay. Say someone crashed through that door right now. You would jump out of your seat.
Yeah.
Because your brain is predicting, I'm sitting in this room. So your brain is scanning the environment 4 times per second to see if anything's changing. I mean, it's wild how aware your brain is of anything that changes in your environment. That's how it keeps you safe, right? So your brain every 4 times a second is scanning, has anything changed? And it's predicting nothing has changed. You're talking to Sophie. Your brain is predicting every, next word I'm about to say. If your door slammed open, you would jump off your seat because the prediction was wrong. Surprise is that if I suddenly changed what I was talking about and started whittling on about, I don't know, bananas and how I always wanted to be a princess with a unicorn, you'd be like, what is she talking about? And surprise would be because you didn't predict I was going to say that. So surprise is another emotion that can be made sense of in terms of a mismatch between what you predict and what actually happens. Actually, you can have a myriad of emotions. In terms of the emotion wheel, we talk about the main emotions because we know that they're universal. We believe that they happen across cultures. But you can actually feel a million things about anything you come across. But the other interesting thing about emotions is you have emotions about emotions. Do you know about this? Yeah. Okay.
A little bit, yeah.
The shake of the head. Okay. So there's so many emotions, but I always just communicate the main basic ones because they're the ones we all understand. Yeah. If you want to get to know your emotions more, definitely look up the emotion wheel. But the important thing to know is a primary emotion is the physical sensation that arises in your body in response to whatever it is you think is going on. A secondary emotion is the emotion you have about the first emotion. So, for example, lots of us don't like to feel angry. Lots of us have been taught, actually, that maybe, especially as women, we aren't meant to show anger. So for some of us, when we experience anger as a primary emotion, we then feel shame as a secondary emotion, or we feel anxiety as a secondary emotion, that feeling of, I wasn't meant to do this. I'm not meant to do this. This feeling is dangerous. So there are so many different emotions, and it's actually much more complicated than I can explain quickly here. But luckily I wrote a whole chapter on it in the book. So if you want to learn more, just go and buy a manual for being human, shameless plug. But yes, one thing to really get acquainted with is the emotion wheel, but also recognize it's not as simple as the thing I feel right now is definitely correct. Because our brain sometimes makes wrong predictions, right? Like, have you ever had a text saying we need to talk from a boss or from a lover?
I don't know if I have. I mean, I've had moments where it's brought up those emotions that you described, maybe not through that text message, but I know exactly what you mean.
Right? That feeling of panic. Like, it's over.
I feel like my body would just go cold.
Right? Because your body is preparing you to run or fight. Yes. Yeah. And when you go cold, when you slip into a sweaty, cold mess, tense, sweaty, cold mess, it's because an efficient machine is a cool machine. So when you're about to run or fight for your life, which is what your brain thinks you need to do anytime you're in perceived danger, it either heats you up really fast or cools you down really fast, because that's what you would need to survive in a fight or run situation. But I did once have a text from someone saying, we need to talk. Oh, no, it was a date. And then I got in there and broke up with them before they could break up with me. I was a teenager, very bad decision. I thought that was a smart thing to do because I predicted they were going to break up with me. Anyway, turns out I was totally wrong. Totally wrong. I broke up with someone who actually just wanted to chat about something. So... our emotions are useful. There can be many of them, but sometimes, as they're based on our predictions, they can be totally inaccurate.
And the book is packed full of amazing tools and techniques to help people to really kind of make friends with their emotions.
And work out if you're over predicting threat, so that you don't break up with a person who's not about to break up with you, basically.
Yes, and mindfulness. I loved how much you talked about mindfulness. I'm actually reading The Power of Now as I was been reading
Love
your
it.
Book.
Yeah.
And I noticed there's a few similarities. So Eckhart Tolle talks about non-identification. Mm. And I noticed in a lot of techniques, it's about that, isn't it? Not identifying, over-identifying so much that, you know...
Well, not believing you are your emotions.
Yes. And that if you're feeling anxiety, it's not that you're an anxious person. It's just that you are feeling anxiety right now.
Yes. Yes, 100%. Because a lot of us do over-identify. I'm reading The Comfort Book right now, which is Matt Haig's book, which is out in a few weeks. And he talks about... he still says he lives with depression, but when his depression was really intense, he would think of himself as depressed, like I am depressed, rather than I am living or experiencing depression right now. And it's such a simple technique, that externalization, But once we do disconnect, when we diffuse from this idea that we are our thoughts or we are our emotions, it ultimately gives us a sense of freedom and helps us recognize that all things that come will also go. And with emotions, that's so important because so many of us feel strong ones and think, I am this, rather than I am experiencing this.
I think emotional well-being, or I guess you could say emotional intelligence, I think is just so important because it's an everyday thing, isn't it? Our body is so smart. It's always preparing us for all sorts of scenarios. And if we can work with it, then I think, you know, that's the path to more peace.
Yes, and better relationships. And what's interesting is they're now showing that they think emotional intelligence is as important, if not more in some cases, as what we've been thinking about for years was the most important thing, as in IQ. So it's so wonderful that they're recognizing that being able to not only, because emotional intelligence doesn't just mean knowing about your emotions, right? It means being able to recognize them, being able to manage them, and then being able to almost harness the power of your emotions in order to act in the ways that you wish to. So I don't know if you know that they think now, for example, that sadness is actually better for creativity.
Wow, I didn't know
that. I know, so cool, isn't it? And then emotional intelligence means being able to do that for other people. So seeing, for example, someone else, recognizing the emotional state they're in, and then not only helping them manage, but being able to understand what they need to harness their emotions to get them to do the things you need them to do with you. So emotional intelligence doesn't just improve our mental health, right? It improves every aspect of our lives and other people's lives. So it's just so important.
So fascinating. I find the more that I learn in psychology, the more I realize I don't know.
I know. Oh, my word. Yes, I know. Me too. Me too. I literally have a doctorate in this and I'm like, I have not even scratched the surface.
You mentioned relationships before, and in the book you talked about the power of understanding your attachment style. I wondered if you could share a little bit about how your understanding, is it avoidant attachment that you...
I have an avoidant attachment style.
You have an avoidant attachment style. Because I think the book Attached, that many of my clients, many of our listeners have found to be really helpful. It doesn't, it's not as helpful for people with an avoidant attachment style as it is for someone with an anxious attachment style. So I thought it would be cool to hear your bit of your personal journey of like understanding about your own avoidant attachment style and how it's impacted your relationships.
Yes, I love that you're saying this because Attached, I think, is probably one of the best psychology-related books I've ever read. I really mean ever. I think it's extraordinary. And I think it was important, actually, that it gave so much focus to the anxious style, because I think avoidant people often get treated as if they're kind of cool. You know, you're like, oh, you're so aloof. It's so sexy. And I think people with anxious attachment styles often get a really bad rap when they definitely don't deserve that. You know, you develop an anxious attachment style to stay safe as a child in the same way as you do avoidant. And it's as impressive as any other coping style. So that's just what I wanted to say about Attached, because I think it's fantastic. But being an avoidant, okay, so the best way I think to think about it is to imagine it's like you're a cat. So, you know, for example, I don't know if you have a cat. I don't have a cat. Me and a cat would not get on because we're both too aloof. But the idea is that when you have an avoidant attachment style, you kind of, you want relationships and you need relationships and you thrive in them, but they kind of feel like they have to be on your own terms. So you may date, you want people in your life, but because you developed an avoidant attachment style very early in life, because people consistently didn't meet your emotional needs, it may only have been one of your caregivers, right? Because you learned early on that you couldn't rely on other people being there for you, you adapted to stay emotionally safe by kind of shutting down the emotional experience and becoming very logical about everything, becoming very independent, being near people, but not really putting your emotions on them. Withdrawing when people get too close to you emotionally because it feels too overwhelming. Much like a cat, you know, I have been around to people's houses and I'm like, oh, hi, cat. And it comes over to me and then I go stroke it and it's like, no, you're too close, go away. So my experience of being an avoidant person is much like that. I am very good at being close to people, but when I used to date, if someone got emotionally too close to me, I would shut down, right? We could even be like, in the sleeping period, I'd be like, oh my word, this is so lovely. I'm so happy. I wake up in the morning, I've totally shut down. It's almost as if the night before didn't happen. And it's not because I don't care. I'm using this as a personal experience that I know covers most people's avoidant experience. It's because as my brain developed to keep me safe by keeping people at arm's length, when I hit a certain threshold of overwhelm in terms of emotional closeness, my brain instead shuts everything down and points out to me everything that could go wrong, but also everything that's wrong with the other person. Like, ooh, an unsightly shoe. I shouldn't date them. Oh, they need me. And then my inner critic will pipe up and even help that experience along even further. Like, told you they're needy. They're going to take away your independence. You can't trust people to hold their own. Yeah. Now, again, it's not because I wouldn't, it's when I was going through this, it's not because I didn't want to be close to people. And it might seem like I was aloof, but actually underneath the anxious and the avoidant exterior is the same thing. Mm. A desire to connect, but a fear that other people can't or won't be there for you. It's just that we adapt in different ways. So the way that you cope with that, because I say that in the past, right? I have an avoidant attachment style, but I have, in inverted commas, earned secure attachment. So what do you do? Okay, so firstly, you understand the avoidant attachment style. You recognize that your brain is going to point out everything that's wrong with the other person. After you have an argument, it is likely to help you remember only the things that they said that were annoying. It's going to help you remember only the things that are wrong. Your brain is trying to keep you safe. Your inner critic is going to point out all the same stuff. So recognize, when you get close, you're going to want to pull away. So what do you do? Communicate this, right? Mm. If you're in a relationship with someone, rather than pulling away, try and have a conversation before that happens, such as, okay, when I'm dating, I tend to shut down on occasion. I need my own space. Once I've had enough space, I then come back. I'm then fully present. But on occasion, I need to disconnect. If we're going to date and you need something different from me, what do you need? How can we communicate so that both needs getting met? So for example, often with me, it's a case of if I'm dating someone who needs, for example, to be text multiple times a day, or they need to know that when I disconnect, I'm still still actually connected to them. I'll be like, okay. So every week I have, for example, 2 days on my own. And I promise within that time, I will text you 3 times. Does that make sense as a kind of basic for how you understand it and how you look after yourself as an avoidant? Ask what you need, but also accommodate other people's needs.
So that communication, that open and honest communication, is radical. Because it sounds so simple when you say it. It's like, that's what we should all do. But it's it's one of those simple, powerful, but difficult to do at first, because it can be, you know, really a bit scary or unfamiliar to kind of share, you know, openly and honestly. But so helpful, transformational in relationships.
Transformational. But remember, of course, both the avoidant and the anxious style think that other people can't or won't be there for them consistently. So that's why it sounds so simple to have these conversations. But if the whole basis of the reason you're doing this is you don't believe people can be there for you, it's not as simple as, oh, I'll just say this thing. Because when you go to say it, you're then like, oh my word, they're not going to be able to be there for me. So you switch into your old ways of coping. So often it does involve practicing saying these things out loud to yourself.
Yeah.
And then when you're comfortable with saying it enough times, you almost have this brain pathway where that sentence has been constructed enough times to be able to say it out loud in reality with someone in front of you.
Yes, I recommend that clients do this. Say it in the mirror or just say it out loud and get your mouth around the words, like just practice.
Yes. And I suppose my final I've got lots of tips about being avoidant. I realized that was a lot of information without very many bullet points, but just simply notice when your brain is trying to belittle someone else, because I think people assume that people with avoidant attachment styles are kind of cold. We're not, right? We're not at all. But our brain can be quite judgy. So notice when you think, oh, they are needy, or, oh, I'm judging them for that shoe. I couldn't possibly date them. And recognize your brain is trying to keep you safe, but maybe trying to put you off from someone you actually could have a good connection with. So don't buy into everything your brain is saying.
Mm-hmm. And what if you are dating or in a relationship with somebody who has an avoidant attachment style, and you notice or you think that this is going on for them, that they're pulling away because it's, you know, you're getting too close. What would you recommend?
Talk about it. talk about it. I mean, the other person may not even realize they have an avoidant attachment style. And one of the things I really, really love is how many people now are dating and doing attachment quizzes together.
Yeah.
It's so cool. So if you can, get your partner to do an attachment quiz. Right? Find out what attachment style they have. And then you can be curious and you do it, do yours as well. Never make it judgy. And they'll be like, oh, that's so curious. No way. So this seems like when you feel overwhelmed, you pull away. Because the problem is once we're in relationships, we often converse in ways that make actual change impossible. I don't know about you, but so many people, and I've done this so many times in the past, will say, you do this, and it makes me feel. Okay. The moment you do that, you trigger someone else's defenses.
Yeah.
And also you're likely to say, you always do this. Mm. Not only does that trigger someone else's defenses, it also makes them think, no, I don't. There's loads of times when I didn't do that. And it shuts down all hope for communication. So the beauty of an attachment quiz, something that you do that's outside of the two of you, is you're able to be like, oh, curious, I do this. Does this resonate with you? It takes away a lot of that kind of sting that can arise in conversations which become very pointed. And if you disagree with it, you can be like, oh, I don't agree with the attachment quiz, rather than I don't agree with you.
Yes. Yes, that's the beauty of attachment theory, the framework that it depersonalizes the challenges.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Mm. And just another point on attachment, there is a whole chapter on this. And it's brilliant because you talk about the, you know, childhood relationships that shape us, you know, the beginning bit of how we got here. And then also in adult relationships, you get this really great journey. If people are interested in attachment theory, the book really takes you on that journey of understanding, you know, where it comes from, and then how we also keep these patterns locked in place in our adult relationships as well, which is brilliant. You mentioned that, let me just find the bit in the book. Yes, so I'm going to read a little bit, if that's all right.
Yeah, please. Love to.
A lot of us fall into old traps. We confuse anxiety with lust and love. We chase the people who push us away and we push away the people who run towards us. So we have to do the work. I just felt like that summarized pretty much all the challenges that I see in my own work as a love and dating coach. In one paragraph, you just summarized it.
Oh, I'm so happy.
I thought it was so useful to read it like this. And then I wondered if you could explain why we can confuse anxiety for lust and love, and why sometimes when the right person is right in front of us, we can kind of think, oh, they're too nice, or just don't fancy them. There isn't that attraction there because the anxiety isn't there. Because I know that so many people really experience this. Could you speak to that?
Oh my word, how many people have I thought, oh yeah, this is it, when actually I'm just totally anxious around them rather than it's the right fit. So if we imagine that we have this thing called an attachment system, it's really, we're now just talking about whether you're kind of activated or not, whether you're anxious or not. So your fight, flight, I can never say that properly. Fight, flight, freeze, forward response. So if you have a secure attachment style, generally being around people doesn't really make you that anxious. Unless you meet someone, I'm sure, who you think, oh my word, I hope they like me, because that's still very normal to feel, even if you have a secure attachment style. But for anyone with an insecure attachment style, meeting someone who could potentially like or love you can make you feel a little bit unsettled, a little bit anxious. And that frisson we feel in our body, we're like, ooh, please come. I want a little bit more of you. Please message me. So a lot of us, what we do is especially because in movies, we've been shown all of these images of love that's kind of frenetic, frantic, exciting, fiery. Because of that, when we feel activated, when we feel anxious, we feel like, oh, this is what lust feels like. That's the first thing. The second thing, and I wonder if I'm going to be able to explain this. Okay, do you know slot machines in casinos? Okay, so slot machines work based on the idea of what we call intermittent reinforcement. Humans get addicted to things much more quickly if they only get the thing they want on occasion. So when you play on a slot machine, generally you put the money in and you don't win. Just as you're about to give up, you know, money comes sloshing out of the machine. So it's not just that when you meet someone that you don't, you know, that you're excited by, they might make you feel anxious. It's the fact that often the people who make us feel anxious are the ones who kind of pull away. And then just as you're about to give up, come back to us. So it's not just that we're a little bit anxious. It's the fact that now we're leading into almost like an addiction cycle, right? Like, oh, I need more of them. Oh my word, I'm so excited by this person. Actually, you're just incredibly anxious and desperate for the next kind of kick or hit of reinforcement. And a lot of us, because we don't understand how attraction, connection, and relationships work, feel these feelings and we're like, I'm in lust, I'm in love, and I need this person in my life, when actually you're just really anxious. Is that your experience of it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely this the fight flight response that can feel, because it's so familiar, I think, for people, particularly if you have an anxious attachment style. So that's my style, but with earned security. I always associated that anxious feeling with lust. Familiar for me in every relationship. And it was reading the book Attached and learning about attachment theory that helped me to see that actually, when you don't feel anxious, when you actually feel safe around somebody, your attachment system isn't activated. Mm-hmm. That's a really good thing. And even if you don't feel that instant attraction, like, that doesn't mean that it won't grow. And I think, and I've seen this with clients as well, when they really give people a chance where they're not sure about them at first, and then they go out with them again and just be open-minded, go on the date with an open heart and mind, and they're able to really just get to know the person in a really calm way. The attraction, I think, grows. 100%. And it grows from a foundation. It grows on a foundation of trust, which is so much deeper and richer.
But when do you see that in movies? You know, you and I, for example, were talking about Friends before. And I suppose Ross and Rachel are an interesting pairing in it, because actually she just sees him as a friend and it does grow on a foundation of trust. But in most movies, actually, when people meet, it's like hot and passionate and someone is anxious about the other person texting back. We've really been sold this idea that for something to work, it has to be fiery from the first instant. And so a lot of us confuse. It's not just that we need to ask ourselves, is this lust or am I just anxious? Is this lust or an activated attachment style? It's also actually maybe this person that I think I don't fancy, and am I confusing a calm attachment system with boredom? Because actually you're so right. Firstly, relationships aren't about finding someone, sometimes it is, but for a lot of us, relationships aren't about finding someone who kind of sets you on fire and then it just working out. For most of us, actually, it's about finding someone you decide to commit to and work with to create a solid relationship. Not someone that you already dislike, right? I'm not saying you can make a relationship work with anyone, but someone who you feel something for and then you build from there. Mm-hmm. So if someone doesn't light your fire straight away, exactly as you're saying, that doesn't mean they won't ever. It means it might be a slow burn.
Yeah, that slow burn metaphor really makes sense in the context of that. Rather than this fiery, drama-filled, you know, experience, it's actually like that slower burn. Yeah.
It can be really sustained. You know, if you think about some of the most whirlwind relationships that are really fiery at the beginning, honestly burn themselves out very quickly. So slow burn, peeps.
Slow burn. I wondered if you could share with us some of the go-to tools and techniques that you use to look after yourself, look after your self-care and mental health and well-being. Are there particular things in your toolkit that you use on a regular basis?
100%. I suppose it depends on what stage I'm in. I think there is a reality that most of us dip in and out of our coping skills. I don't know what you think about that. So during times of high stress, you're much more likely to find me doing mindfulness every single day, doing breathing exercises as if my life depends on it. Going into, before really stressful meetings, I'll do breathing exercises on the way, and then I'll do star jumps in the bathroom when I used to go to interviews in real life.
I love that.
Because actually we know, to burn off all that stressful energy, right? When your body's in fight or flight. So during times of stress, my coping skills toolkit is slightly different to the rest of the time. And when I'm kind of in the in-betweens, for me, what's really important is exercise. So I go to yoga nearly every day. I normally do it with friends because I need the accountability. And I'm much more likely to go if a friend is also going there.
Mm-hmm.
Having friends who aren't afraid to be flawed and to talk about that openly. We have a group of friends who are totally just like loving the fact that we're all imperfect and honest about it. So exercise, the knowing that I have a toolkit for times of stress helps, but mainly it's my friends, you know, people I can talk to at any time of day. I also do have therapy and she's absolutely amazing. So I kind of have all bases covered, you know, what I do during times of calm, what I'm doing in times of stress and how I maintain it through friends and therapy.
I was imagining kind of this triangle then, kind of like a Maslow's hierarchy.
I've got every layer of Maslow's hierarchy of needs covered.
I sometimes get a bit of anxiety. It's like nervous excitement before I interview somebody. So this morning in your book, I did your 5-4-3-2-1 technique.
And how did you find it?
It was incredible because I often... breathing techniques and putting my hand on my heart and breathing, that's usually my go-to. Because I was reading the book, I tried the 5, and would love for you to explain what it is.
Mm.
By the time I was doing the 4 things I could touch, I think touch is, it's C, yeah, I felt instantly like I could feel my heart rate was slowing down, I felt safe, and it was, I think it was even quicker than a breathing exercise for me. I felt instantly just calm.
Yeah. Yes. So you're talking about a grounding exercise. And actually what's really interesting is most people assume that if you're struggling or if you're stressed, you should go straight for a breathing exercise. Now, absolutely, if you're really skilled in breathing exercises, great. But breathing exercises are really hard if you're stressed out and if you haven't done them before. And actually, if you've experienced trauma, breathing exercises are not for you. Focusing on your body can re-trigger traumatic events and flashbacks. So grounding exercises involve focusing your attention outside of your body so that you can start processing the information that also says to your brain, you are safe. You are in an environment of calm. You can relax now. You can switch off your fight or flight. So for a lot of people, it does work much faster. We would call a grounding exercise almost the thing that you do to apply the brakes to your runaway train of emotion. Yeah. Breathing exercises are more for, yes, you could be on the verge of panic, but they're more your kind of general go-to skills for stress, and grounding is for overwhelm. So to do it, you just say 5 things you can see. Then you say 4 things you can touch, but you actually touch them. Then you say 3 things you can hear, 2 things you can smell, 1 thing you can taste. The last two are kind of tricky because often you're out and about and there's not really anything to smell.
Yeah.
So I've been really, really anxious before, like, oh, there's nothing to smell. So you just sneakily sniff your top or your breath. And then for 1 thing you can taste, it's great if you still have a toothpastey mouth or a drink in front of you. But for lots of people who experience overwhelm all the time, they're prepared for this, right? I know people who carry around limes in their pocket or essential oils that they can sniff or bite into. Bite into the limes, not the essential oil.
Oh, limes as in like fruit.
Yeah. Oh yeah, because they're so sharp. Like if you want to ground yourself quickly, bite into a lime or a lemon.
Wow. Yeah.
It's intense.
Yeah, I'm just imagining it. Oh, I've never heard that one before. That's fascinating.
Yeah, we used to experience things a lot, so it's very effective.
Amazing. So what is the key message that you'd love for people to take away from your book?
Gosh, definitely that whatever it is you're experiencing, it can be made sense of. You are not alone. You are not broken. You are human. And even when times get really, really dark, there's always something that can be done to make that time a little lighter. And there is always hope. Sometimes you'll need someone else to carry that hope for you. Sometimes that'll be a friend. Sometimes it'll be a therapist. Sometimes it'll be the little voice in that book. But whatever you're experiencing, it makes sense. And you are human.
Oh, I feel so full of love.
Oh,
thank
me
you.
Too. That's so nice.
Well, I've absolutely loved this conversation. So good to have you on the podcast. Is there anything else that you would love to share as we close?
No, just thank you so much for listening and having me on. And yeah, hope we have a sunny summer. Oh, and buy
me
my
too.
Book.
Yeah. Well, so the book comes out 8th of July, isn't it?
Yeah.
We will include the link in the show notes to pre-order. So pre-order now, and the book is out on the 8th. It's amazing. Please go out and buy it. It's just packed full of really super useful practical tools and techniques that can help you to live a peaceful and happy life, I would say.
Yay.
It's amazing. So yes, we will put all the links in the show notes. We'll also include a link to the feelings wheel and attachment quiz that we mentioned as well, so you can find it all in there. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Project Love podcast. We really hope you enjoy this episode. And if you did, then come and subscribe on iTunes and we'll deliver each new episode straight to your device. And we would love it if you would leave us a review to help us spread the love far and wide. And if you can't think of anything to write, then just tap 5 stars and say, best podcast ever. Thank you.